Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me. Well, it was good enough for my grandpa. It was good enough for my grandpa. That was good enough for my grandpa. That's good enough for me.
It's no surprise for the superstitious or mystically inclined like myself that today's story starts on Friday the 13th, June 13th. But this is June 13th, 1862 to be exact, in South Weber, Utah Territory.
And just a quick PSA for listeners, I'm from South Weber, and it's Weber, not Weber. Same for Weber State. You people in the East are fired for pronouncing this wrong all the time. But back to our scene. 1,000 armed men have surrounded a makeshift fort on the Weber River. They've dragged cannons up onto the ridges. The bluffs look down into the encampment below, a cluster of dirt and willow cabins, a bowery, and a few hundred frightened people.
Inside the fort, a bugle sounds, not from the militia outside, but from the prophet within. He's gathered his people to hear a revelation. But this is frontier Utah territory, and when we say prophet, we usually mean the big guy, Brother Brigham Young. The prophet held up inside this fort isn't him.
A man with dark hair and a soft English accent stands before the congregation. He has a message from God. The Lord has promised that the enemies will be destroyed. The faithful will be delivered. Christ is coming. He's been coming for a year and a half now. Any day, any hour, no one's ever heard that story before, the congregation settles into the Bowery, someone begins to read the revelation aloud, and then a cannon fires.
The ball ricochets off the plowed earth in front of the settlement and tears into the crowd, killing two women, shattering the jaw of the third, and the Morrisite War begins. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Today we're telling a story that almost nobody outside Utah knows, and honestly, a lot of people inside Utah have never heard of either. It's one of those stories where the more you dig, the more your jaw drops.
Too soon.
It's actually a story that will repeat itself over and over and over and over again in Utah, making us the true crime genre for streamers and documentarians.
This story has all the right ingredients. A prophet, a fort. Did you hear that, Lindsay? There's a fort at the center of this. An apocalyptic community that stopped planting crops because Jesus was literally on his way. A territorial militia with cannons, a three-day siege, and a killing that sparked a murder trial 17 years later. This is the Morrisite War of June 1862, one of the most dramatic and tragic episodes in Utah territorial history.
And we want to give a shout out right at the top to our friend Seth Bryant, who has been a great supporter of this podcast and one of the historians we pull from today. Seth, this one's for you, pal.
Before we get into the event itself, we need to understand the man at the center of it. And Joseph Morris is fascinating. We might call him the OG Windjammer. That one's for you, A.S. This is not a simple villain story. It's not even a simple story at all. So let's talk about Morris. And the first thing I want to say is, if you're going to build a profile of someone who might break from a religious institution and start their own movement, Joseph Morris checks about every box. He's born in 1824 in Burwardsley, Cheshire, England, a coal miner, a farm laborer. He's a bit of a fun-sized guy. He's maybe 5'6", by all accounts, well-built. He's got dark eyes, long dark hair that fell in ringlets. And historian G.M. Howard, who wrote a key article on all of this, described his complexion as almost feminine in its whiteness. There's something otherworldly about the descriptions of him, even physically.
He's converted by Mormon missionaries in his mid-20s, which is a pretty common story for the era. Marries Mary Thorpe.
Oh, did people just get converted earlier, younger back then?
I guess refer to last episode if you want numbers of ages. So he marries Mary Thorpe and they tarry in St. Louis for a couple years and he works as a fireman on the Mississippi River boat. And then they move to Pittsburgh where he serves as branch president of the local Mormon congregation.
And here's where the pattern starts. Because Joseph gets relieved from that position, apparently because the congregation is dissatisfied with his teachings. So even before he gets to Utah, there's friction between Morris and institutional authority. He arrives in Salt Lake City in 1853. Things don't go great, personally. His wife leaves him. The historical sources suggest this was at the urging of the local bishop, though that's disputed. She takes the child, takes everything. He remarries, but then that wife files for divorce within 6 months.
He has terrible luck in marriage, which we'll revisit because it actually shapes some of the later revelations in darkly interesting ways. He drifts San Pete County and Provo, a brief stay in Salt Lake, and he ends up in Slaterville in 1860, which is a little farming community just north of Ogden. And this is where things start clicking for him.
Now here's the important context. Let's back up just a bit. 1857 in Utah, of course, the heart of the Mormon Reformation, the Utah War, this intense religious revival that Brigham Young is pushing throughout the church. Blood atonement, repentance, rebaptism, loyalty oaths. There's a frenzy in the air, and Morris throws himself into it completely. He's rebaptized, he's set apart as a teacher, and he starts preaching with tremendous passion.
And what he's preaching against, at least in part, is polygamy. Morris has arrived in Utah in 1853 completely blindsided by plural marriage. He'd had no idea. Remember, it gets announced a year earlier publicly. And so he shows up, he's like, what? And he never reconciles himself to it. To him, it's adultery, full stop. Because so many of his eventual followers were in the exact same position. Most of them are Scandinavian converts, especially Danish, who'd been baptized in Denmark and spent all his time and resources and pain immigrating to Utah. And then they arrive to find the church that they've joined looks kind of like a frontier sex cult. And the shock of polygamy was real for a lot of people. So his stake president, James C. Snow, pulls him off his teaching assignment, turns his back on him, stops speaking to him. His wife leaves him. Morris blames Snow directly, and Morris is utterly isolated.
And in that moment of complete desolation, he prays. He's already earned the nickname Praying Joe in Provo. This prayer is a little different because he comes out of it with a revelation. The Lord has spoken to him. He has been chosen, quote, from before the foundation of the world to be a mighty man, yea, to be a prophet in Israel. Which, for a man who's been rejected by his church, his wives, his congregation, that's about the most profound spiritual experience you can have. Of course, he believes it. And then he writes to Brigham Young.
Oh, the letters. Brian, tell the people about the letters.
So our prophet here, Mr. Praying Joe, writes to Brigham Young. Some might say also a prophet. His opening proposal is essentially, I am a prophet, and you should be my first counselor, and together we'll run the church. I'll hold the prophetic keys, and you'll handle administration. Now, given Brigham Young's personal style, that might not actually have been a terrible arrangement. This letter, however, and multiple follow-up letters, surprise, surprise, go completely unanswered.
Prophet to prophet, I don't understand. You'd think there would be some collegial respect there, but for years, Young never responds once. I wonder why. I mean, he's not a guy who had earlier said he could shit a better prophet when an earlier potential rival was being talked about. And to be fair to Morris, that's exactly how Joseph Smith was treated when he was first claiming revelations. And yet people ignored poor Morris or mocked him or rejected him. That's the pattern. So maybe to Morris, it was even more confirmation. Remember, when we covered the Winter Quarters era with James Emmett and the frontier break-off sex cult, Morris isn't an anomaly. When you lay the ground rules for a religious system based on personal revelation and breaking with the religious status quo, this is kind of bound to happen, you guys.
And boy, did it ever. By 1860, these revelations are flooding in. 13 in September alone. And they're getting pretty specific. George A. Smith, Brigham Young's first counselor, has been revealed to Morris as literally a fallen angel, a devil, who is secretly running the church into the ground. The Mountain Meadows Massacre? Well, that was all George A. Smith's fault.
And the second coming is imminent. That is the drumbeat running through everything from the beginning.
Isn't it always? If you're a 19th century prophet and you're not out there yallering about the second coming, your case is going to get reversed on appeal. Joseph Morris, in our case, is the seventh angel from Revelation. A comet appears in September 1860. He interprets it as the tale of the army of heaven following him. His revelations end with, "I am Jesus Christ, even so, amen and amen."
I mean, that's one way to deal with divorce, I guess. He asks his employer one day in a very Christopher Nemelka way, he just asks, "Do you know who I am?" And his employer says, "Yes, I do know that you are a prophet of God, for the Spirit has told me so." And that's the first testimony he's ever received in his life. Can you imagine what that felt like for little praying Joe? After everything he'd been through, probably felt like the sky opening up and sending a tail of comet to follow you.
By the fall of 1860, with all this going on, the Slaterville Ward is in crisis because Morris has converted a substantial portion of the community. The entire ward bishopric is alarmed. Morris gets leaned on to leave, and 31 of his followers are excommunicated for apostasy.
But here's the thing, getting excommunicated actually helps him. He heads to South Weber, where he falls in with a man named John Cook, whose brother Richard Cook is the ward bishop. And Richard Cook, the actual bishop, listens to Morris preach, and he's immediately convinced.
This whole thing is so wild, having grown up there. All these last names, these are the ancestors of all the people I knew growing up. To know that these nice, gentle, loving people had such a colorful ancestry, one with this stark period of resistance to the mainstream. Within weeks, the movement is spreading through South Weber. The general authorities send apostles John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff to investigate.
And I look at this story sometimes as like another crazy break-off sect, which it is. But also, like, think about it. These were all people that believed firmly in God and in a doctrine. And yet they're like, but polygamy sucks. And we see that it sucks. And I mean, we're seeing movements like that today with like the snuff rights and the polygamy denier movement. They're like, I want to hold on to these things, but not that thing. And so you have to come up with religious claims to do so. And so at this meeting, they asked Bishop Cook point blank, so what do you believe? And he says, I believe Joseph Morris is a prophet of God and that Brigham Young is not. 9 men and 7 women stand up and say the same thing, and they're all X'd on the spot. Drama, drama.
Wilford Woodruff closes the meeting with a prophecy that Morris's influence will rapidly diminish. Morris then uses as a testimony of his own calling when the exact opposite happens.
Enter John Banks, because Morris needed not just converts, but credibility and organizational muscle, and since Brigham turned him down, Banks brought both.
John Banks is one of the more interesting supporting characters in this whole story. He's an English stonemason, one of Mormonism's earliest British converts. He's baptized by Parley P. Pratt himself. He becomes the president of the London Conference of the British Mission. Andrew Jensen, who wrote the LDS Biographical Encyclopedia, called him one of the ablest and most eloquent missionaries to serve in England. So he's right alongside like guys like Woodruff. Woodruff had known him earlier.
And he comes to Utah as a founding settler of Pleasant Grove. He then went back on a mission to Ohio and came home expecting to be appointed presiding bishop of the church. Brigham Young had essentially promised him that office.
Except when he shows up to claim it, Young says it's no longer available. Words are exchanged, things escalate, Banks physically chokes Brigham Young during the altercation.
He physically chokes the prophet of the church. This is buck wild.
Not surprisingly, he's then immediately excommunicated for unchristian-like conduct. Now, you should know that what we just told you is one version of what happened. This is apparently family lore from Banks' son, Franklin. In another version, with contemporary sources, he's actually excommunicated. It's even the same day as the family account, but it's in connection with another dude for writing letters in the Valley Tan that were critical of Brigham Young. To muddy the waters even more, in Wilford Woodruff's journal, we see he understands that Banks had been excommunicated like a whole year earlier. And what's even odder is the account of him being excommunicated out of Brigham Young's journal, kept by scribes, when they copy this into the sort of quasi-official history of the church, Banks is no longer there. His whole story is very murky.
Well, I'm going to fall asleep at night with the family lore version.
It's definitely more fun.
So Banks goes back to Pleasant Grove and farms, which he's terrible at by temperament and experience. And he and Morris had met many years earlier and bonded over their mutual grievances about the hierarchy. And then Morris receives his revelation September 6, 1860, that names Banks specifically as a replacement for Heber C. Kimball in the leadership of Morris's new church. How convenient. He gives him exactly what he needs. So Banks leaves his wife and children in Pleasant Groves and joins Morris at South Weber.
On April 6, 1861, the 31st anniversary of the founding of the LDS Church, Joseph Morris officially organizes his church, the Church of the Firstborn, with six founding members. Wonder where he got that number. Joseph as prophet, seer, and revelator, Richard Cook as first counselor, John Banks, the second counselor, with a quorum of 12 apostles.
And the theology is remarkable. Let's just lay it out because it's genuinely different from mainstream Mormonism in important ways.
Right. No polygamy, racial equality. The priesthood is open to everyone regardless of race. Women can hold the priesthood. All property is consecrated to the Lord. They talk about reincarnation. Morris taught that he was the reincarnate Moses. The second coming is so imminent that planting crops is practically a sign of faithlessness.
That's what farmers who can't farm would like to tell their...
Well, Jesus is coming soon, so...
I suck at it, so we don't need...
What's the point?
Yeah. And the righteous Mormons in their theology after Christ comes will become servants of the Morrisites. So that's convenient. So, you know, the well-meaning polygamous Mormons, they'll learn the truth. And the unrighteous Mormons will be slain by the hosts of heaven.
Bad news. First thing that Jesus will ask for is a sack of potatoes.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Read your scriptures, boys. The growth of this group is extraordinary. Within a week, 53 members. Within 3 months, 200. By the time of this Morrisite conflict, 14 months later, they're getting close to 1,000 followers, although about half of that number are baptized members still.
It kind of reminds me of Denver Snuffers movement, right? It's very, very similar.
Foot in both camps for a lot of them.
These are people leaving the LDS Church. This is a significant hemorrhage from the Mormon community in Weber and South Davis County. What is it about Davis County, you guys and all your break-off sects?
Well, see, the northern, it's a little more chill. It's, yeah, once you go south, that's where the boys and Barlow.
That's where the plagues are.
It gets a little interesting once you get south.
Some about the land. I'll tell you who's not pleased about Davis County. Brigham Young is not pleased.
How unpleased? He will call them the Davis County Bandits from the pulpit, which I have to say, if we ever get like a semi-pro football team or something, that better be the name. He directs Mormons have no commercial dealings with the Morrisites. This is the standard plan. You don't sell to them. You don't mill their wheat. Nothing. And don't murder them, but I'm not saying not that either.
Okay, so this creates a real hardship in the 1860s very quickly, because remember, the Morrisites are already not planting crops because their bishop sucks at farming. Because Jesus is coming.
Your head now, what have you done? Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head now, what have you done? It's time to say goodbye. Hang down your head now.
Well, let's talk about what life looked like inside Kington Fort, because it's important context for understanding why things fell apart.
Kington Fort, and I'm going to say this spelled K-I-N-G-T-O-N. I have to spell it out because I kept wanting to call it Kingston Fort because it's Davis County. It's named after Bishop Thomas Kingston. It's not Kingston. God, I did it again. Bishop Thomas Kington, not Kingston with an S. Though a lot of historians got that wrong, not just me. It was originally built in 1853 on the Weber River at what's now South Weber, a 10-acre square enclosure with log cabins built around the perimeter. And it has been abandoned when Johnson's army approaches in the 1850s.
Yeah, this paragraph is wild because I grew up in a very traditional chapel there in South Weber. Display case out in the hall with all of the previous bishops of the ward. So there's Thomas Kington, the first guy. My dad's down at the bottom. This is all quite personal.
You come from a proud heritage of weirdos.
I don't know how many people know about this part of the history. Hopefully,
you know what's
a lot.
Weird is a couple of years ago, I got leaked. This is real. I got leaked some documents from general authorities in Davis County, scared and almost excommunicating state presidents who had gone off the rails for the snuff rights. It's very, very similar. I'm telling you something about the land up there, like, which is cool. Cause like, if you're going to break off from Mormonism, you don't do polygamy. You know, Davis County is more known for that than say Bluffdale.
And then, but also on the flip side, the heaviest pro-polygamy folks come from there.
Yeah. Well, did they come from there or did they, well, did the
Kingsons?
No, well,
Lauren Woolley, right there.
Were they
Centerville.
Okay. You know what? My data's flawed. It's not polygamy. It's just break-off sex. We get all kinds.
You get both.
Multitudes.
Yeah, Davis County contains multitudes. All That's right. your right. takeaway. So Joseph Morris takes over the fort in 1861. He's got converts streaming in from all over the territory. They're living in tents, they're living in wagon boxes, whatever improvised shelter they can get. An intense building program starts. The materials are primarily woven willow reeds and dirt. Two walls of woven willow with a foot of dirt packed between them. Earthen floors, bow roofs covered with soil. It's fairly primitive.
And remember, this is not a fortified military installation. This is a desperate millennial community waiting for the end of the world, living in mud huts. And it's 1860s Utah, which is kind of the vibe already.
And the harassment from the surrounding Mormon community is relentless. They steal their horses. Armed dudes ride into camp to provoke fights. People threaten to destroy the food supply. They don't know what to do with these weirdo dissenters right in the middle
it's
of
it. It's basically Facebook in the 1860s. Like, you can't harass people about doctrine on Facebook. Like, Mormon communities argue with snuff rights now. You just go steal their horses.
And of course, from the inside, it's very easy to see that these are just trolls, clearly, disrupting the kingdom. It's obvious.
Crying that Clayton's journals are forged.
The reeds and the willows were all fake. People are threatening to destroy their food supply. You get a particularly grim incident in November 1861 where a group of armed, like, teenagers basically burst into the schoolhouse and physically assault residents. They get them out eventually, but then those guys will swear out a complaint against the Morrisites for defending themselves.
And big surprise, the Morrisites lose in court. A man named Peter Boss is convicted of assault and sentenced to 40 days hard labor. After that, the community position becomes, we will accept no more legal authority from civil courts. They're not going to get justice there. Who does that sound like?
Meanwhile, internally, the community is under enormous strain. Food is getting scarce. The Second Coming has been announced, obviously, and has failed to materialize multiple times. Spoiler alert, like it always does. Every time a date comes and goes, a few more people grab their belongings and take off. And the property issue becomes incredibly toxic. The Morrisites pooled everything because, of course, they believe in the consecration of all personal property as a core principle. When people left and wanted their stuff back, the custodians had to make decisions about what they'd get, and the stayers consistently felt that leavers were taking better quality stock than they'd originally contributed. And fun historical fact, the office was actually just across the river in Uinta, just for the fact so they could then call it the UEP.
Is that real?
No, it's not. Definitely not.
Well, now I'm questioning everything because you're woolly. You pulled out the woolly card up there. I don't know anything anymore. Okay, so there's growing resentment on both sides. The people who stay feel cheated. The people who leave feel cheated. And then there are revelations about Morris's troubled marriage. So by 1861, he's remarried a Danish convert named Mary Olson. He had a thing for Marys, I guess. And things were rocky from the start. The revelation he receives include one that basically says, your wife must obey you or God will cast her off. Wait a minute. I thought we were finally getting gender equity in this frontier sex cult. I guess not.
Using divine revelation to manage your marriage problems is a pattern we've seen elsewhere in Mormon history. I feel like specifically threatening your wife might have come up before.
We have some experience with that topic on this podcast, yes.
Okay, now it's early 1862. Three dudes, William Jones, John Jensen, and Lars Gertsen, all leave the community feeling deeply cheated on their property settlement. Jones in particular was one of Morris's very first converts from Slaterville, and he is not happy about how it's turned out.
Oh, running your own church on the frontier is easy, you think, says Brigham. So they do something audacious. A wagon of wheat is being transported from Kington Fort to Kaysville to be milled because Mormons won't mill for them locally. And the three men intercept the wagon and seize the wheat.
The Morrisites respond by sending out a posse under Peter Klemgard, who is one of the captains in Morris's newly organized community militia. Those never go off the rails. They capture all three men, recover the wheat, bring them back to the fort, and lock them in a log cabin.
To be, quote, tried by the Lord when he came. So I love that excuse. Hey, we're not going to handle this right now. As soon as Jesus comes, we'll figure it out. I'm going to tell that the next time my boys fight over the remote.
Fun fact, another historical trivia here. All of these details about them locking them in the log cabin come from a Martha Brotherton letter. So it never happened. Okay, that also is fake. All right, now this is both very on brand for the Morrisites, but it's also, I think you can see, legally kidnapping. Gertson eventually escapes. Jones and Jensen do not and stay locked up.
And their wives go to the authorities, and word reaches Chief Justice John F. Kinney, a non-Mormon appointed by James Buchanan 2 years earlier. Now remember, the North has a little bit more Gentile influence because of Ogden. Ogden becomes a Gentile outpost. So Kinney issues a writ of habeas corpus, and Deputy Marshal Judson Stoddard goes to the fort and reads it aloud to Morris, Banks, and Klemgard.
They let the writ fall to the ground. They will not receive it. Answer them nothing.
How many times do fundamentalist break-off sects have to take that? Like, if you're going to be a fundamentalist sect, let's make it easy. The t-shirts say, answer them nothing. That's what your t-shirts say. So Stoddard, in his understated account, notes simply that, quote, he went home unsuccessful.
A second writ is similarly dishonored 3 weeks later. I can't remember which specific time. It might have been that first one. One of the stories is that somebody goes over to the fire, grabs live coals, and just chucks it on the paper. And that's when you hope it's true, because it's a nice dramatic
sassy
statement.
Yeah, it's a little dramatic. I like it.
So after the second writ is also ignored, Kinney goes to the acting territorial governor, Frank Fuller, and says, all right, we got to kick this up a notch. We need militia now. So Fuller activates the territorial militia, a.k.a. the Nauvoo Legion, as a posse comitatus for the arrest of the Morrisite leaders.
And here's where we need to talk about Robert T. Burton, because he's going to be the most contested figure in this whole story.
Burton is the deputy territorial marshal, but he's also a colonel in the territorial militia and a man who has been fighting, like, basically his entire adult life, like, fighting in Utah. He's been in the Nauvoo Legion since 1844. He fought in 6 campaigns against Indians in his first 3 years in Salt Lake Valley. He led guerrilla operations against the Army during the Utah War. He is a military man through and through, and he kind of sees the world in military terms.
And it's worth noting that Territorial Marshal Henry W. Lawrence refuses to participate in this operation. He thinks an armed confrontation is wrong. A little extra. He leaves the territory rather than lead the posse.
And that's pretty wild. Like, the actual marshal is not interested in going. So the deputy, Burton, takes charge. Also, store Henry Lawrence's name in the back of your mind for a later episode.
On Thursday, June 12th, 1862, an armed posse of 500 men leave Salt Lake City heading north. They pick up volunteers in Davis and Weber counties as they go. And by the time they arrive in South Weber on the morning of June 13th, Burton has somewhere between 500 and 1,000 armed men.
And cannons. 3 cannons, by some accounts, including a famous piece called Old Sow that had originally belonged to the Nauvoo Legion. And name your your weapons again.
Like Old Sow? Like an old, yeah, that's quite the name. They position themselves on the bluffs southeast of the fort with contingents on the flats to the east and the west, and the militiamen from Ogden to the north, so they're basically surrounded. Kington Fort is completely surrounded.
Burton sends his surrender demand into the fort via a Morrisite herd boy because sending an actual officer seemed, you know, maybe a little risky. The demand? Surrender within 30 minutes. And this is interesting. This is a big debate. How long did they give them to decide before all hell breaks loose?
And it's contested?
Yeah. Like, obviously, the militia will argue that, oh, no, we gave them plenty of time to make a decision. You see the word reasonable come up. And not surprisingly, the Morrisites on the inside are like, they said surrender, and then like the last word is still echoing away when they start shooting.
So they get this demand for surrender, and what does Morris do? Well, he retreats into privacy to receive a revelation. He's got to ask Jesus.
The revelation he comes back with is essentially this. The Lord says the enemies will go so far, and then he will stop them. They have almost gone far enough. The Lord will fight your battles. He will intervene at the right moment. Boy, does that sound familiar for like a late 1880s time period.
This is where we started at the top of the episode. He has the bugle sounded. The entire congregation gathers in the Bowery. And remember, the Bowery is just the outdoor meeting space just west of the fort in a grove of trees. And they open with prayer. A man named John Parsons, who had what the sources describe as a voice remarkably suited for the occasion, reads the revelation aloud.
What's wild is descendants will describe his voice as very Gilbert Gottfried-like, which I don't think was appropriate.
The Parrot of Aladdin.
Maybe.
It's fine. You can only go so far.
Richard Cook then stands up and begins expounding on its significance. Remember, this is the former, like, branch leader who has been caught up in the movement.
And then cannon fires from the hillside.
Confusion, confusion. I was sticking to my shoe.
The first ball, probably meant as a warning, hits the plowed ground in front of the settlement. The second ricochets off the earth and tears into the Bowery, right where the congregation is gathered, right where Cook is standing.
Two women are killed instantly. Mary Christofferson's jaw is shattered. One of the women who dies is a nursing mother. Doesn't help the PR, Mormons. Cook shouts for people to go back to their homes and defend themselves, and the Bowery empties in minutes. The Morrisites are badly armed, a few rifles, some shotguns, short-range weapons against a militia with cannons on the bluffs. They're trapped.
Some of them fire back. Because a 19-year-old militia member named Jared Smith is hit and killed and becomes the only government casualty of the war, and P.S. will absolutely piss off the higher-ups. This guy had been engaged to be married, and after his death, his brother-in-law married his fiancée the next month.
Yikes, that's a lot.
And then, rain moves in that afternoon. It rains through the night, all of June 14th. The militia has by now expended most of its cannonball. The Morrisites, again, like, they're not really interested in fighting back. They're mostly just huddled in their willow and mud cabins. And that's the part you kind of come back to, because these people genuinely believed. They're sitting there in their little dirt houses while cannon fire is shaking the ground around them, because they are waiting for Jesus to come. They have been told that the enemies have come almost far enough. That's what the prophet has told them will happen. When your ammunition is gone, he will come to the rescue. The revelations keep coming right through the siege. Each one is promising delivery. The Lord is just waiting for the right moment, and then he will deliver them.
June 15th, Sunday, breaks clear and bright, and the militia has essentially run out of their cannon shot, and it's quiet. There's a moment that historians note that where if you are a Morrisite, this peaceful Sabbath morning must have felt exactly like that threshold of the millennium.
And then the shooting starts again. So the militia rigs up this wagon chassis covered with brush and boards like a makeshift shield, and they put some riflemen, and they push it with foot soldiers toward the fort. And keep in mind, by this point, the Morrisites have been under siege for 3 days. They're starving, they're exhausted, they're terrified. They raise the white flag, and then John D. Lee, wrong thing. Robert Burton rides into the encampment. And this part is where it really gets disputed, because we get two very wildly different accounts of what happens next.
Why don't we trust the Mormon accounts? They always told the truth about these sorts of things. Okay, why don't we read both, shall we? The first is deposition of Alexander Dow given to Associate Justice Charles Waite in April of 1863. And here's the quote. The Morrisites had surrendered, a white flag was flying, and arms were all grounded and guarded by a large number of the posse. Robert T. Burton and Judson Stoddard rode in among the Morrisites. Burton was much excited. He said, "Where's the man? I don't know him." Stoddard replied, "That's him," pointing to Morris. Burton rode his horse upon Morris and commanded him to give himself up in the name of the Lord. Morris replied, "No, never, never." Morris said he wanted to speak to the people. Burton said, "Be damned quick about it." Morris said, "Brethren, I taught you true principles." He had scarcely got the words out of his mouth before Burton fired his revolver. And then?
The ball passed in his neck or shoulder. Burton exclaimed, "There's your prophet." He fired again, saying, "What do you think of your prophet now?" Burton then turned suddenly and shot Banks, who was standing 5 or 6 paces distant. Banks fell. Mrs. Bowman, wife of James Bowman, came running up, crying, "Oh, you bloodthirsty wretch!" Burton said, "No one shall tell me that and live," and shot her dead. A Danish woman then came running up to Morris, crying, and Burton shot her dead also.
This is brutal. This is an account of a cold-blooded murder after surrender. And we have another witness to the scene, Emma Thompson, a Morrisite whose family was present. She wrote later in her own words, quote, "We Morrisites thought that none of our number who were faithful could be killed. Even when Morris was shot and fell lifeless to the ground, we did not think him dead. I saw the wadding fly back from his clothes and thought it was the bullets rebounding him. We considered him invulnerable." Her father, George Thompson, sat on Morris's body saying, "Now kill me, for I have nothing more to live for." When Burton aimed his pistol at Thompson, the gun misfired.
Which, if you think about it, if you're a Morrisite, that you could take that as a sign. George Thompson survived and actually went on to become a significant figure in the subsequent history. Now, Burton tells a completely different story at his murder trial in 1879. He says Morris called his followers to arms during the parley. The crowd charged toward their stacked weapons. Burton gave the command to halt, then fired at Morris. He claims he didn't see any women, aimed only at Morris, that Mrs. Bowman never addressed him. And the jury, when he tells this at trial, was half Mormon, half non-Mormon. They deliberated 2 days and came back with a verdict of not guilty. And that's kind of crazy. 17 years after the event, the trial lasting 2 weeks for a killing, this trial in 1879 for a killing in 1862. And the result, when Burton enters the encampment, is the same in either case. Joseph Morris is dead. John Banks is mortally wounded. He will die the next day. 2 women are dead, Isabella Bowman and an unnamed Danish woman. Several others are wounded. 90 men are taken prisoner and marched to Salt Lake City in a 2-day journey.
And in typical frontier fashion, Morris and Banks were put on a wagon and displayed in front of City Hall in Salt Lake City before burial.
And the trial happens in March 1863. 7 Morrisites are convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to prison terms ranging from 5 to 15 years. 66 others are convicted of resisting arrest and fined $100 each.
The new territorial governor, Stephen S. Harding, who of course is federally appointed, not Mormon, pardons every single one of them 3 days after the convictions.
And that's kind of his statement about what he thought of the entire proceeding. He privately described it as the old story over again. There is not room in the Roman Empire for 2 Caesars.
And Brigham Young is pissed.
Well, he's the real Caesar.
He's the real, and there's not room for more. Judge Kinney adds to the court record a denunciation of the governor's actions as creating a threat to law and order.
And that's an interesting dynamic, right? Because the judge is like, "Governor, what are you doing, dude?" He's not Mormon either. So we've got very differing perspectives on how to deal with this.
The pardon drives another wedge between the federally appointed territorial government and the Mormon establishment. But for the Morrisites, the pardon comes too late for it to matter much in Utah. The hostility toward them after the pardons is intense. Many of them seek protection at Fort Douglas, which was really all you could do if you made enemy of Mormons in Mormon territory. You had to find a soldier's fort. And so Fort Douglas at this point is the new federal military outpost on the bench east of Salt Lake City, the result of the Utah War. And this is where they like point the cannon at the in the middle of the valley, right at the Lion House. And this is from General Patrick Connor's California Volunteers that staff it.
Connor, you might remember, is the evil villain responsible for the Bear River Massacre just a few months earlier in January 1863, where his troops killed anywhere between 250 and 400 Shoshone men, women, and children. The same man is simultaneously a generous, protective friend of the Morrisites. Can't imagine what all the Morrisites had in common that the Shoshone victims didn't. I feel like there might be
a threat there.
So Connor organizes 2 wagon trains to carry the Morrisites out of Utah. One goes south toward Carson City, Nevada, the left wing of the Great Eagle. One goes north to Soda Springs, Idaho, the right wing. 160 people, 53 families, all escorted by troops.
They found a little town called Morristown, and it fails. Maybe because they don't know how to farm. The climate is brutal, in their defense. 5 consecutive grain crops are destroyed by freezing and bad attitudes. And more than half the livestock die in the second winter. And most people eventually scatter. I think failed prophecies, failed crops over and over might destroy your faith. But one woman stays and her story has to be told. It's Mary Christofferson, the young woman whose jaw was shattered by the first cannonball in the Bowery. And she survives. She marries a blacksmith named Niels Anderson at what is believed to be the first wedding ceremony performed in the newly created Idaho Territory, July 20th, 1863.
She carried the disfigurement of that wound for the rest of her life. There are pictures of her as an older woman, and you can see she got blasted by a cannonball. Her husband, Niels, founds the anti-Mormon political party in Idaho. Then when they die, their children commission a 650-word inscription for their gravestone, describing what they call the Morrisite Massacre and denouncing the deception in Brighamisms. Their bitterness outlasted them.
The deceptions in Brighamisms is like a complicated band name, but I think somebody should take it.
I feel like it's either punk, maybe heavy metal.
I think it's like synth punk. Yeah, there's deceptions and Brighamisms is too.
Do they have like Gary Newman makeup, or is it more like Flock of Seagulls kind of thing?
I don't know, but you can blast a cannonball like as a lyric, so that sounds dirty.
Oh yeah, that's the one. Like their big hit, right? At that one moment, they blast the cannonball into the crowd.
Yeah, into the jaw. Yeah. Okay. The largest concentration of Morrisites eventually settles in the Deer Lodge Valley of Montana. And here the story gets even stranger because into the vacuum left by Morris's death steps a man who calls himself the Prophet Canaan. George Williams, who's an obscure Englishman living in Salt Lake City, begins claiming in late 1862 that he's had visions too. And here we go again. He was riding his horse near Hacker's Canyon when snow fell in a marvelous manner. A cloud formed an enormous archway spanning the valley, folding doors open to reveal the armies of heaven. And Jesus himself appears to Williams and says, "All hail, thou son of the highest," and embraces him and commissions him to lead the church of the firstborn.
So Williams claims this is actually his third reincarnation. If you're going to make a claim, go bold. Why say this has only happened once? So he's Canaan in the first, Melchizedek in the second, and now George Williams. So hence the prophet Canaan. He governs his church almost entirely from England through letters, which if, you know, George had listened to our episode on mail, he'd realize was a terrible idea because it goes really slow. Maybe he should have invented the Pony Express. He actually never visits Montana, where most of his followers live. He designates Deer Lodge as the future site of the Second Coming and the city of the Great King. He sends 2 missionaries, Al Marion and Hannah Groh, across the United States to England, France, Austria, Turkey, to personally deliver a divine message to the Sultan of Constantinople. Now that's an ambitious mission. Hannah Groh, unfortunately, dies in San Francisco on the return trip.
So now, yet again, these poor Morrisites, they've got competing prophets. Maybe they got off on that. There was something special in the tension there. A man named William W. Davies breaks away and in Walla Walla, Washington, establishes his own communal kingdom in which one of his sons is the reincarnate Jesus and another son is God the Father. That kind of beats Canaan, I gotta say, if you're looking at the Bible. And that kingdom stands until 1880 when both sons die of diphtheria. Did you ever know that Jesus and the Son of God died of diphtheria in 1880 in Walla Walla, Washington?
Even the highest among us sometimes were not vaccinated, Lindsay. I mean, this stuff, this reincarnation stuff, especially, you can't make this up. The Montana Morrisites limp along through decades of leadership crises, excommunications, splinter groups, and slowly dwindling membership. Not long ago, we got some periodicals by descendant traditions of the Otto Fetting branch of Mormonism. And I was trying to decide which one belonged to which group. And of course, I turned to Steve Shields' fantastic research on all the groups. And it was mind-boggling how many schisms happen in this tiny, tiny little group. That's exactly what's going on here. You have 43 people and they split into seven groups. It's quite impressive. Now, what's really fun is their little white meeting house in Racetrack, Montana.
Great name.
Has an inscription above the door, the House of the Lord. It still stands today. It's in disrepair. Friend of the podcast, Eric Rogers, has done a lot of really interesting work on Morrisite history and did a fantastic presentation, I believe, at John Whitmer. And in one of his slides, he shows this little meeting house.
Incredible.
So when I was like, oh, I connected that. I was like, that's the building that Eric did the picture of. So really fun history.
Well, you'll be sad to note that the last Morrisite leader was a man named George Johnson, who presided at the House of the Lord until shortly before his death in 1954 at the age of 98. He played the fiddle at Saturday night dances. He sounds like the best prophet they've had. Like, I want to prophet the fiddles. Do you
He's
hear that,
among
Brigham?
The people. He's not sitting over in foggy London town, not visiting the people.
Sure, our guy built ships. This guy plays the fiddle. By then, the Millennium Fire was long cold, though, and the church was officially disbanded in 1969. All right, so let's sit with all of this for a minute. What actually happened here? And Brian, what do we make of it?
I think the most important thing that historian G.M. Howard argues, and pretty compelling, is that there's a tragedy of mutual misunderstanding. Robert Burton didn't quite understand what he was walking into. The Morrisites didn't understand who was coming at them.
They thought it was a Mormon military attack in a religious war because that's what their prophet had told them would happen. And every single one of his revelations had told them, the armies of Mormonism will come against you. This is Armageddon. The Lord will come when your ammunition runs out.
And they weren't entirely wrong. It was a religious war. This is a thing. Okay, sure, it's the territorial militia. This is essentially Brigham shutting down another rival, right? It was a religious war, but not the kind they think, right? They're expecting a biblical religious war. This is Book of Revelation, right?
They're waiting for Jesus to come in and stop the bullets.
Exactly. So as a result, the writs of habeas corpus, the federal marshal, the practical legal machinery of the U.S. territory of Utah, none of that registers. These are just chaff here. These are details of the final battle before the millennium. And Burton, for his part, comes in with cannons. He's not at all interested in the particular religious sensitivities of what he's facing. Howard makes the point that the Morrisites at the time of the siege were already collapsing from within. We talked a little bit about this. Defections are increasing. The leadership is fracturing. A patient siege without cannon fire might well have produced a peaceful surrender within days. Burton's biographer argues that Burton actually suggested this earlier, and then when that was not approved, he did his duty as a military man. Maybe. That is an interesting idea.
I mean, but we hear those defenses in Mountain Meadows. I mean, this brings up the larger question, one that strikes me at the story, which is, like, this is a story about, like, the state versus a millenarian religious community, right? But Mormons just did that. They just did that literally just a few years earlier with the Mormon Rebellion, and now they've got their own. Now they become the state in the story.
Oh, they're in charge. They're driving the bus.
That's right. And that now they have it. Like, how did they deal with it? And it's interesting to hold Brigham Young's defenses against the government and his persecution up to this story, right? It just becomes a whole different ballgame. The Morrisites didn't think that they were subject to early authority, just like the Mormons didn't think they were at the state. They'd essentially seceded from civil society. Who does that sound like? They had their own law, the Lord's judgment coming any day, and the state couldn't engage with that worldview at all. This is very Girardian mimetic violence. Communities collapse on themselves and sort of like eat their own and fight their own marginalized.
And then you've got the question of Brigham Young's role in this. So some scholars have argued persuasively that Young is just squash the movement, not just because the prisoners thing, but because 1,000 of his people Mormons had left. The Morrisites are an existential embarrassment. Let them wait 1,000 years, he said from the pulpit after the siege when someone asked about the Morrisites ever returning to the church. That's not really the words of a guy who's neutral on the question.
And then there's the story of the women, Isabella Bowman, who shot dead, allegedly for calling Burton a bloodthirsty wretch, and the unnamed Danish woman shot running to her prophet's body, Mary Christofferson, carrying the mark of that first cannon shot for the rest of her life and dying with it, you know, on her gravestone. And the women whose husbands were imprisoned, the women who went to the territorial authorities in the first place to get their husbands freed, which set the whole legal machinery into motion.
Women are all over this story, often invisibly. That cannonball that starts it all falls into a congregation where they're also gathered, listening to this revelation. One of the balls from that fight still lives in South Weber. I heard about that growing up. There's even a monument now in South Weber today. The DUP and the SUP put it up in 2006. It's on a street corner near where the fort stood. On a good day, I could throw a baseball from my mom's driveway and hit it, and a lot of people don't realize that it's there. I thought it was very entertaining. There was a list of 3 things to visit in South Weber on some travel site. This was one of them.
I mean, honestly, if these guys had done this today, they would be excommunicated and have their own podcast on YouTube. Like, that's what would be happening. But here, these people were, like, killed and murdered. It speaks to Brigham Young's insecurity a little bit. And it's weird because most people have never heard of this. And that's why we do what we do. This is Utah history. This is Mormon history. This is American history happening during the Civil War in a territory fighting its own miniature version of the question tearing the country apart about authority and law and who gets to use force and when.
And Joseph Morris is part of a tragic pattern. He's another one of these broken zealots who found something true or something that felt true to him in moments of complete abandonment. He's got his own trauma he's working through. And he builds this community around him, but then that community falls apart under the weight of wanting for a God who didn't... fell apart under the weight of waiting for a God who didn't come.
And 8 people died because a cannonball ricocheted.
And because no one on either side understood what the other side was actually doing.
Even though they should have. They've all been on both sides, both of them.
When the minority becomes the majority, they often don't learn their lesson. And like so many fiery millennial movements, this one burned to the ground. But, and this is the important takeaway, South Weber is fantastic. We should not be prejudiced against South Weber.
All right. Great Peruvian food, I hear.
Great windjammers.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned.
Decide yourself if the Books of Mormon's report's going to stay. Reason it could polish up the gray. Put that up your wall. This isn't country at all. Books of Mormon's report, decide yourself. Powered by Benchmark Books. So the definitive history of this movement comes from Leroy Anderson. And it came in a really interesting way. He inherited 2 major manuscript collections from different eras of this group and used them to write a book on the Morrisites. There had really not been a whole lot before that, largely because the documents were still sitting in people's basements. The latest edition of his work is called Joseph Morris and the Saga of the Morrisites. And for a biography of the controversial character Robert Burton, see Janet Siegmiller's Be Kind to the Poor, The Life Story of Robert Taylor Burton. Spoiler alert, it will definitely argue that Burton didn't mean to kill anyone and regretted it, but it was necessary. As always, you can get these and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Good enough for Billy Burroughs. I was good enough for Billy Burroughs. I was good enough for Billy Burroughs. It's good enough for me. Sister, don't get worried. Send avenging angels, brother Brigham.
spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, brother Young. Let only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.